Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
It's twilight time. Out of the mist, your voice is calling. Tis twilight time.
When purple. It is the Savage Nation. Welcome to the program from the United States of America. I have some news for you. Those of you who have been following my band from the United Kingdom, I know you want to hear about the Union Thugs beating up average Americans at so-called town hall meetings, and you'll hear about that. It won't make it to your local paper or the department store dummies on CNN, ABC, NBC. MSNBC will not cover Obama's Union Thugs beating people up at town hall meetings. You will not see a black man being beaten up by Union Thugs at town hall meetings. You will not hear from the ACLU or any of the other ordinary criminal organizations like them complaining about Union Thugs beating up ordinary Americans. No, you won't hear about that on ABC, CBS, NBC, or MSNBC, but you'll hear about it on the Savage Nation. You'll find out that the Democrats are actually conducting a wholesale Bolshevik revolution in the United States of America right in front of your nose. But I'm not going to get to that. In fact, it's Rock and Roll Friday. The open number is 1-800-449-8255. MichaelSavage.com is the website. I'll do hard politics later, but it's Rock and Roll Friday. I also have an update for you from England. I got it this morning from my attorney in England, and we will confirm again that Michael Savage has not been taken off the list of people banned from entering England, that this evil government, the Labour Socialist fascists in England, God help us with these leftists, these evil fascists in England have listed Michael Savage along with murderers and terrorists, some of whom were in jail for killing up to 10 people. They confirm in writing, that is, the current Brown administration confirms in writing to my lawyer that there is no truth in the news articles and that Michael Savage is still excluded from Britain. You're not going to believe it when I read it to you. I will also read you my lawyer's refutation of the evildoers in England. So until we get to that, let's go to the Rock and Roll Friday calls here on the Savage Nation. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. Strange things are happening in my life right now. Strange things are happening in my life right now. Let me give you an example. I've heard from people I haven't heard from in over 40 years. Out of nowhere. No reason for it. Then the other night I had a very telling dream. A lot about this show is about me. And sometimes I disclose my dreams, which are quite vivid, because I take a lot of pyridoxine or B6. And when you take a lot of B6 of pyridoxine, you get technicolor dreams in 3D with surround sound all between your ears. The best show in the world is my dreams. I've often wished somebody could invent a wire that you could attach to your head like a cap where your dreams can be put onto a TV screen and recorded. I wouldn't have to go to the movies, nor would you. Unbelievably great dreams. Again, if you have been obotomized or you are suffering an obotomy, turn the show off immediately. It may be dangerous to the remnants of your mental health. If you have an obotomy, you're not going to want to listen to the show. If you have been obotomized, you're not going to want to listen to the show. Instead, you'll listen to the Union Thugs and the Bolsheviks running America right now. So anyway, strange things are happening to me. I had a dream the other night where I spoke to God, and I didn't see him. I don't know what he looks like. After all, I'm not Jimmy Carter. I don't drink strychnine, and my family never waved snakes around in the living room. But in this dream, I was saying, I'm kind of spacey. There's no center now. I don't know what to believe in. I've lost all faith in government. I've lost all faith in everything, including time itself. And then God said to me, in order to have a center, you have to know God. And as though in a satori, as they say, instantly I remembered what I had known for so many years and had wandered away from. That when you come to know God, you know yourself all over again. You're strong as a mountain. And really, nothing can penetrate you because you are connected to the heavens. So, having said that, then strange things started happening again. As I said, an old friend I hadn't seen since college days saw the article about Michael Savage in The New Yorker, sent me a note. He's going to remain anonymous. I preserve people's anonymity. And we spoke today by telephone. After a couple of days, we tracked each other down. I got to tell you the story without divulging who the individual is. This is the individual whose car I accidentally wrecked. He had a Jaguar. Remember that story? And I took the Jaguar for a ride on Queens Boulevard after 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning. He let me drive it. It was like a 58 XK150 convertible. He gave me the keys. We had a great night of partying. It must have been 2 in the morning. I go out on Queens Boulevard in New York. And, okay, I opened it up. Nobody was on the road. I stop at a traffic light. Nobody is on the road. It's an empty road, 2 o'clock in the morning. All of a sudden, I look at a little mirror. They had little mirrors, rearview mirrors. Careening towards me is a horrendous car coming at me so fast, before I could get the car in first gear, bam, the car hit me. Broke the back of the Jaguar, smashed it, broke the frame, broke the back of the car. Cops come, I was innocent, I hadn't been drinking. The driver, by the way, was an Iraqi national. As God is my witness, he was an Iraqi national with a long Iraqi name. I know you say, what does that have to do with anything? I don't know. Getting hit in the back by an Iraqi, I don't know. Okay, it has something to do with something. I go back to the party. I have to tell my friend I destroyed his beautiful car. And I don't remember what I said. Now, let me move the clock forward 40 years. After my friend and I talked today for the first time in 40 years, he sent me an email, sent me a there. I called him. We exchanged numbers. He says to me, do you remember what you said to me the night that you wrecked the Jaguar and came back to my apartment to the party? I said, no. He said, you walked into the party and said, punch me. I just wrecked your car. I said, oh, my God, I didn't. I said, say that again. He said, you walked into my apartment in front of everybody with a straight face. You said, punch me. I wrecked your car. I got to tell you something. I respect my younger self a great deal for that. Maybe I knew my friend was a gentleman and wouldn't do it, but I did mean it. And I'm sorry, by the way, for wrecking your car. Well, that was a long time ago. Here we are in America today, where we have a communist revolution with Obama, an absolute neo-Marxist by any measure. Now, many of you don't understand terminology. When you hear the word communist, right away you bristle and say, oh, come on, that's just rhetoric. I have told you that there are many varieties of socialist and many varieties of communist. They're not all one style, not one type. There are at least 30 varieties of socialism. Therefore, there are varieties of communism. And if it walks like a communist, if it talks like a communist, it is a communist. And Barack Hussein Obama, by all definition, is a neo-Marxist. How many times have I told you it was fair game for the left to call those around Bush neocons? Remember the sneers? Neocon this, neocon that. Of course, that was code words for Jew, as you well know. When they were saying neocon, they were referring only to the Jewish people around George Bush. But okay, we don't have to go down the ethnic road, but we knew what it was. So neocon was acceptable to the vermin in the media, right? Well, why is neo-Marxist not acceptable to the rats in the media? Because they are the same. They're from the same bolt of cloth. It was cut in Leningrad in 1917. Now, you have to understand the sequence of what we're going on, what we're experiencing in America today. And in order for me to explain to you what I mean by the communist revolution that is occurring in America and what you must do to prevent the wholesale destruction of everything your ancestors dreamed of and fought for in this country, I will take some time to do that today. I also must tell you something else happened in addition to an old friend calling after I had my dream about God. a distant cousin of mine who I hadn't spoken to in a number of years sent me an email and said, we found some letters from your mother and father when they were first dating. We found some correspondence from your grandparents when they were first becoming American citizens, some of their notebooks that they had to read to become U.S. citizens. You might want to see them. I got them this morning. You're not going to believe the books that immigrants had to read to become Americans. Now, compare that with the crowd we have in America today sneaking across the border. I'll be right back.
Savage.
It is Rock and Roll Friday on the Savage Nation, blasting out from San Francisco to all of America.
Yes, you appeal to me.
This is the Cleftones, isn't it?
I'll never say.
Cleftones, they went to Jamaica High School as well as I. I didn't know them at the time. Are there any Cleftones, any Clefts out there listening to the show? I mean, I know Fats Domino, I heard, listens to the show. Any actors and entertainers are secret conservatives, and they listen. I think my audience is a much different audience than you might imagine. They say it's the third largest show in America in radio. Whatever, the number doesn't matter. It's the quality of the audience. So here we were talking about politics, memory, God, personal stuff. Now, first, I want to read you something, a little paragraph. I know it sounds teachy and preachy. Emily Dickinson, you may know her name, an old white woman, lived between 1830 and 1886. I don't think she's taught anymore. I think instead they teach Emily Has Two Daddies or something like that. But Emily Dickinson wrote this. 'Tis the majority in this as all prevail. Assent and you are sane. Demure, you're straightway dangerous and handled with a chain. I'll read that again. 'Tis the majority in this as all prevail. Assent and you are sane. Demure, you're straightway dangerous and handled with a chain. Emily Dickinson. That's the preface to my book, Banned in Britain, which I'm almost finishing right now. That's the opening couplet to the book. Because this is what Obama has brought to America. Now, we used to hear under Bush that he took away our rights and the Patriot Act, you're going to go to jail. That was all a lie from the communist left that has now taken over America. They're the ones who want to put you in a chain. They're the ones unleashing the union thugs at town hall meetings. They're the ones shutting people up. They're the ones buying three Gulfstream 550 jets for Speaker Pelosi's personal use and the people in Congress. They're the ones bankrupting the healthcare system by robbing you blind for charges that don't even exist, for patients that don't even exist, from doctors that don't even exist. And in all of the talk about healthcare reform, have you heard one page devoted to cleaning up the criminality in the healthcare system? Not one word, have you? Billions and billions of dollars are being stolen from the healthcare system, and not one word is being addressed about that by the demon cats. So we were talking about that. And we now go back to something else. I have such little time when I get worked up, I have to read this to you. So my cousin sends me a packet of old material, including pictures and letters from my dad to my mom, God rest their soul, my grandparents' citizenship book. Listen to this. It's a little book, and it says First Drill Book in Reading English by McAvoy. And I see my grandmother's handwriting in here. Here is the opening page to this book that immigrants had to read. Introduction. The illiterate adult is tragically handicapped, for he is unable to read the simplest direction or to write his name. As some of the men and women themselves express it, they are blind, because although they see the printed word, they are totally unaware of its meaning. Those teachers who have labored long and patiently with these self-conscious, diffident adults deserve the gratitude of all who are interested in the happiness and safety of their fellow beings and who long to see a higher and more intelligent type of citizenship in this country. Mrs. McAvoy is a sympathetic, successful teacher who has shown rare insight into the problems of these adult students who are making so heroic a struggle to free themselves from the bonds of illiteracy. Now compare them to the ones with the gangbang tattoos, with the hand signals. They may as well be using smoke signals we're letting into this country, taking over places like Texas, Tennessee, States that were once American, taken over by radical gangs because of the communist liberals who have said that they all come here to work. They all come here to work? Then how do you explain that one out of three prisoners are illegal aliens who came here to kill, murder, deal drugs, etc.? What, are you kidding me? This goes on. Carolyn Whipple, Supervisor of Immigrant Education, State Department of Education, Albany, New York. Remember now, we're talking about a book from the period that my grandparents came over. They had to read these books for the citizenship test. It concludes with this. Suitable teaching material for illiterate adults is scarce, for most of the textbooks on the market are written for the literate non-English-speaking foreigner and are consequently altogether too difficult for the first steps in acquiring a new and difficult language. This excellent little book, therefore, will be a boon to many a teacher in this field who is trying to lead adult pupils into the path of enlightenment and richer living. In other words, America was a place of enlightenment and richer living. They understood that people who came here from the third world understood they wanted to be enlightened and they wanted to have a richer life. Today, what do the communist Democrats tell you? Your culture is garbage. Obama goes around the world and tells everyone we should be ashamed to be Americans. He apologizes for being an American. He apologizes for America, the greatest beacon of light the world has ever seen. We have an enemy within the gates. An enemy within the gates, ladies and gentlemen, is less to be feared than this man in the White House, according to tens of millions of Americans who have awakened to the gang that has taken this country over. Now, I know many of you don't agree with me for your own reasons. I know that a goodly percentage of you are federal workers, and you don't have a stake in the health care reform debate because you have your own health care. Many of the listeners to this show do not know that federal workers are in their own system. They don't even contribute to Social Security. Did you know that? Did you know that the tens of millions of federal workers do not contribute 10 cents to the Social Security system? Are you aware of that? Do you know that they contribute to their own little secure retirement funds that cannot be used by illegal aliens, that cannot be used by individuals who do not qualify for Social Security? Are you aware that the federal bureaucracy has their own safety net? You're not aware of any of this because they won't tell you, and their minions in the media won't disclose this to you, will they? But I will tell you, because I know so much that you need to know, all of you illiterate adults.
Savage.
There's a moon out tonight. Let's go strolling. There's a girl in my heart. Whose heart I've stolen. There's a moon out tonight.
It is Rock and Roll Friday. I know many of you are driving right now to a, I guess, weekend destination, or you're there already. Some people are, well, it's 34 minutes after the hour on the West Coast. Some are going home, getting ready to go home. Long, beautiful weekend ahead, and you don't want to hear about town halls turning violent. You don't want to hear about Nancy Pelosi and the thugs buying $65 million G550 jets for themselves with your money. You don't want to hear about people shouting at Pelosi in Denver. You don't want to hear about physicians in Houston screaming that they don't want socialized medicine. You don't want to see ordinary Americans being arrested in St. Louis for standing up to a lousy, low-life congressperson. You don't want to see union thugs unleashed beating up ordinary Americans. You don't want to hear about that. I understand it, too. Believe me, there's only so much you can take. And many of you say, what can I do about it anyway? The answer is you can go to a town hall meeting and shout at them. You can shout at these lousy, phony Bolshevik Democrats. They think that you're a moron. They live in their own world. They actually think that you want what they're trying to give you. They are so deluded. You know, there was a report the other day that 27 million Americans or 37 million were on antidepressants. How many years has Michael Savage been telling you that Congress should be drug tested? How many years have I said to you the only explanation for their behavior is that most of them are on drugs? That our leaders are drugged. I don't mean they're junkies. I don't mean they're crack addicts. They're on prescription medication, which makes them even more dangerous and more unpredictable. They're robotic. They are dangerous robotic individuals. You can watch them talk. You can see their syntax. And I am telling you, they're on antidepressants. So you say, well, so what? I am too. Meaning you are. Well, I'll tell you what, so what? It explains an awful lot of what's wrong with America. It explains how the ruling class, so to speak, is so out of touch with the people. They don't understand what's going on around them, nor do they care. They are drunk with the insulation in which they live. They are drunk on the insulation. They may as well be sniffing glue for the kinds of things they're trying to pass in this country. But you know all of this. You understand all of this. Of course they should be drug tested. If you go take a job to work for a police department, fire department, school, don't you have to be drug tested? Many other jobs require drug testing, and yet the people who write the bills that take billions from us, they're not drug tested. Why not? Why are they not drug tested? How do you know they're not on crack cocaine? How do you know they're not on marijuana? How do you know they're not drunk? How do you know they're not on dangerous drugs? You don't know any of that, do you? And that explains why this country is in a state of almost ruination. I told you, and I told this story 5 years ago. I don't think I repeated it once. It'll be stolen by tomorrow, or perhaps by tonight. Perhaps before it leaves my lips, the hemorrhoid with ears will steal it and somehow get it out on a blog. But I'll take that chance anyway. The hemorrhoid has such good ears, he does not need eyes. But anyway, that aside, I told you that China was once imprisoned by the British with opium. Do you remember that story? That the British had flooded China with opium in order to, well, for profit. And many original American fortunes were made in the opium trade. They were the mules, the transporters, including a family by the name of Delano from Boston. That name may ring a bell. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, one of Obama's heroes. Now, I'm not saying his family's involved. I know they aren't, for sure. But the Delanos made their fortune transporting opium for the British into China. Did you know that? That's right. The Delano family, you check it out, were big in the transportation of opium to China. You say, well, what does that have to do with the price of beans? It has a lot to do with the kind of president that FDR was. He was the first of the Bolsheviks in American presidential sequence. But let's put past history aside. All right, so the Chinese are imprisoned, or enslaved, rather, through their drug addiction by the English, who dumped opium on them. And how did the Chinese people break the yoke of English domination and of opium addiction? There was an event called the Boxer Rebellion. I can't give you the exact year. I recall it was in 1908 to 1913, in that era. Beowulf, please look it up. My memory is often off on dates, but it's in that period. There was a Boxer Rebellion, and I believe it was a large group of nationalist Chinese who were all martial artists who kicked the verminous Brits out of China. They got rid of them. They burned the opium, and they started to kill the drug dealers. And they took China back from the imprisonment of drugs. Interesting little story. You say, well, what does it have to do with town hall meetings? Well, nothing and everything. But right now, I think what you're seeing with the violence at the town hall meetings, you are seeing average Americans standing up. And what's shocking, oh, it was earlier than that, Boxer Rebellion, 1898 to 1901. Okay, I was off by 8 years, 7 years at the earliest. You've got Nancy Pelosi saying that they brought swastikas to the meeting. Nancy Pelosi is probably the loopiest person in the history of the American government. Not only does she look crazy, not only does she talk crazy, but she acts crazy, and she acts like a mini dictator. Oh, I love what they said. Women were going to bring compassion to the American government. Yeah, Barbara Boxer, Barbara Mikulski, Dianne Feinstein brought tremendous kindness and maternalism to the American political machine. Yeah, the year of the woman, 1994. They really revolutionized the political structure when the women entered Congress and the Senate. Wow, did we get a better country, didn't we? Just take a look at Boxer, Feinstein, Mikulski, and the other women, and tell me they brought beautiful civility to the government. Unbelievable to me. So you got Pelosi up there saying that the protesters are dressed a little too well for her. They must be plants of the insurance industry. It's unbelievable to me when you had the Democrats using Black Panthers with clubs during the election. You had the Democrats using acorn thugs, ginning up fake votes across America. So they were actually intimidating and stealing the election, as they have done in Chicago since God time immemorial. So we are now in the grips of something you never thought you'd see in America. Now, I got to tell you something. There was a book written years ago, which I've referred to on the Savage Nation, entitled It Can't Happen Here. And I read it once, remember? It Can't Happen Here, about the takeover of the government by a small group of right-wingers, what would happen in America. Unfortunately, what's happened is a small group of left-wingers have taken over America, and they meet the prediction of the author of that book, It Can't Happen Here, almost to a T. And I'll read that to you in a few, in maybe 15 minutes. Let's go to the callers on the Savage Nation. Austin, Texas. Matt, go ahead, please.
Just wanted to tell you that in the Bible, it actually says that God will speak to you during your dreams. And so if you want to start writing those down, I think that'd help you out a lot.
Start writing what down?
Start writing your dreams down. You got a dream or anything like that?
I don't write them down. I talk them out. I talk them out on the radio show if I think that they're of any interest to the audience. I mean, that dream doesn't require much interpretation, you know. It was just, it was a direct discussion somewhere inside my soul.
But
with,
he will do that.
With God.
He will do that.
All right, my friend. Thank you very much. It is the Savage Nation. 1-800-449-8255. Joshua, it's written, and the sun stood still and the moon stayed until the nation had avenged themselves of their enemies. And the sun stood still and the moon stayed until the nation had avenged themselves of their enemies. Then spoke Joshua to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel, and he said in the sight of Israel, Sun, stand thou still upon Gibeon, and thou, moon, in the valley of Ajalon. And the sun stood still, and the moon stayed, until the nation had avenged themselves of their enemies. That's what the Bible said. But that was then, and this is now. You're listening to The Savage Nation, 1-800-449-8255. Let's go to Los Angeles, KGIL country. Chris, you're on The Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Dr. Savage. I love that Jaguar story you told about your friend's Jaguar when you were young. But nowadays, I think... If that were to happen today, you probably would have sued your friend, right, for because the rearview mirror was too small or something?
No, he would have sued me for breaking his car in half. But we didn't do that with each other then. Things happened, and we understood it. That was the last thing we would have done, was sued each other in those days. Nobody thought that way.
Right, of course. Hey, listen, what I want to talk about was liberalism. And I love the book you wrote, Liberalism is a Mental Disorder. But when liberals...
when do you think my books will be burned by the Obama administration? At what year do you think it will be before my books are banned in America and burned in a pyre by Nancy Pelosi?
It's like the book 1984, right?
Yeah. Oh, many books have been written about that. One of the best books on the subject is Fahrenheit. Was it Fahrenheit 450? What's the 451? It's the temperature at which paper burns. Fahrenheit 451, a stupendous book, turned into a pretty amazing movie years ago. Anthony Burgess wrote it. And I have no doubt that my books will be banned by the Obamaites if they're not stopped. I don't mean today. I don't mean tomorrow. It will happen that books such as Liberalism is a Mental Disorder will be banned in England and in the United States of America because they so aptly describe the disease of those who have hijacked this fabulous Constitution that we inherited. So what's on your mind other than all of this, Chris?
Well, what I wanted to say was when liberals are on television or on the radio, they will not admit the truth. They will skirt around it. But if you
wait a minute, hold on. That's not limited. You mean when politicians of any type are on the media, they generally don't tell you anything, right?
Okay, that's true. But my main point is if you can get a liberal in private and the reason I'm bringing it up, I have a family member who shall remain nameless that I've had a few discussions with it on, and they openly admit when you talk about different topics, if you're talking about foreign policy, they will admit to you, America is a bad country, it's an evil country, we've done all these terrible things. If you're talking about affirmative action, they openly admit that blacks and Latinos need affirmative action because they are not as intelligent as...
So you have suicidal relatives, in other words. You have suicidal relatives who may as well immolate themselves right now for the guilt that they carry. You know, I watched a show the other night that I had to turn off on National Geographic about Hispanic gangs in Nashville, Tennessee. It got me so angry to see them boasting about how stupid the police are, saying the police suspect but they can't catch us because of the laws in this country, dealing drugs, murdering people and getting away with it. And then you see the cops who are brave enough to strap on a vest every day and go out and try to clean the trash off the streets. And they are undermanned, undergunned in this country. And then you got the liberals undermining the cops on top of it all. How can a country survive when you have everything so upside down? How can you let gangbangers like that proliferate through America and tell the police that they're evil? How is that possible? By the way, Chris, are you still with me, Chris?
I'm here.
Okay, let me ask you something. Next time one of these mentally ill relatives say that to you, give them a quick one answer, a quick short answer test. Just say to them, okay, let me ask you a question. You're walking down a dark street in Los Angeles at night and you're alone. And you don't have you have only a cell phone. And across the street are three people who look dangerous. Let's put it to you that way. And they start to walk across the street at you. You have only a minute to make a phone call. Ask them if they would call 911 for a cop or ACLU. Ask them which number they'd call.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. No, ask them. Ask them what number they'd call, 911 or ACLU. You think Marvin from the ACLU will come out and help them? You think Marvin will run out from behind his law books and help them? Have a nice day. I'll be back.
Savage.
There go my baby, moving on down the line. Wonder where.
It is the Savage Nation. So we're in the throes of a early communist revolution in America. Make no mistake about it. Look at Obama's history. The most radical leftist senator when he was a senator. Then he becomes president. There are questions about where he was born, whether he's an American citizen. As you well know, they're not being answered. Putting that aside for the moment, he is surrounded by a school of thuggery from Chicago that is obvious to anyone who has studied the issue. We have people doing things that have not been done in America, maybe in 100 years. For example, remember the White House posted a blog on Tuesday that asks supporters to email any fishy information seen on the web or received electronically? Fishy information, so they want to keep an enemies list. They want their supporters to become snitches when they see any so-called fishy information about the healthcare debate. But this is illegal. According to a Fox News analyst and a judge, he says that this is illegal. It violates the privacy statute and that prohibits the White House from collecting data and storing it on people who disagree with it. So in other words, they're probably creating an enemies list of anybody who uses free speech against the health care plan that they have and says, well, wait, it's too expensive, or why does it cover illegal aliens, or how come it doesn't cover the criminals? You hear? This is now considered a crime by the Obamaites, and you could wind up on a list and perhaps in a year visited by an acorn thug or a new green thug with a gun who reports only to one of the criminals inside the White House who was lifted from the gutters of Oakland, for example, and given an official position in the White House to create a brown shirt brigade in the United States of America. The Boxer Rebellion, going back to ancient China, occurred between 1898 and 1901. The Boxer Rebellion, more properly called the Boxer Uprising, or the Righteous Harmony Society movement in Chinese, was a violent anti-foreign, anti-Christian movement by the Righteous Fists of Harmony, or Society of Righteous and Harmonious Fists in China. In response to imperialist expansion, growth of cosmopolitan influences, and missionary evangelism, and against the backdrop of state fiscal crisis, natural disasters, and drug addiction, local organizations began to emerge in Shandong in 1898. The Society of Righteous and Harmonious Fists, known by foreigners as the Boxers, was a secret society founded in Shandong, located in the north province of China. Westerners came to call well-trained athletic young men boxers due to the martial arts and calisthenics they practiced. So in other words, when Pelosi comments that the people showing up at the town hall meetings are wearing white shirts and ties, and they must be therefore dangerous, she is in very, very wonderful company. So very interesting what's going on. Those who do not know their history are condemned to repeat it, you see, and that's why we must pay very close attention to the great Spanish writer. Notice I don't call him Hispanic. He was Spanish. His name was Santayana. I had to read him in college. Today, the only Santayana that anyone knows is probably a rock and roll musician from the 1980s. The illiterate adult is tragically handicapped, for he is unable to read the simplest direction or to write his name. Now, this is interesting stuff. This is the citizenship book that my deceased grandmother had to read in order to qualify for her citizenship examination. She wanted to be an American. She wanted to write English. She wanted to be able to understand common English. So she read this little book put out by the State Department of Education in Albany, New York, Supervisor of Immigrant Education. And it says the illiterate adult is tragically handicapped, for he is unable to read the simplest direction or to write his name. Suitable teaching material for illiterate adults is scarce, it reads, for most of the textbooks on the market are written for the literate non-English-speaking foreigner and are consequently altogether too difficult for the first steps in acquiring a new and difficult language. This excellent little book, therefore, will be a boon to many a teacher in this field who is trying to lead adult pupils into the path of enlightenment and richer living, in other words, to become an American. And yet we have a president who says America is not enlightened. America did not grant tens of millions of people enlightenment and a richer life. He's president, but he still plays the race card. He's president, but he still claims he's an oppressed minority. So when there was an altercation between a troublesome professor who has gotten everything in his life by screaming race in a crowded nation up at Harvard, the president immediately, in a knee-jerk reaction, took the side of the race baiter against the white cop. It was such an embarrassment for Barack Hussein Obama that he had to invite the two of them to the White House for a beer. And so, therefore, ladies and gentlemen, times change, times don't change. The only thing that changes now is that you don't recognize that we have a dictator in the making and that you still have the power. You have all the power, and you can stop him. Many of you are doing it. You're going to town hall meetings, and you're shouting at these little Bolsheviks called congressmen, senators, state senators, state legislators, and you're shocking them with the truth of reality. You are the voter. They never met you.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Friday on the Savage Nation. Remember when Bush was in power, and I was an early and consistent critic of Bush. In fact, I called him a fiscal socialist a year before people realized what he was doing to this country. Do you remember when there were organized protests in Congress by groups such as Code Pink and all the leftists who would break up meetings and go into Congress? Do you remember how the media would laud them? Do you remember how the media would make them into heroes? Well, now that non-organized protests are occurring, now that ordinary Americans are standing up to the gangsters who have hijacked America, the vermin in the media are calling them things such as Nazis. They're claiming that they are organized by conservative think tanks. They are saying that they're organized by anti-tax Tea Party sympathizers. They say they're organized by the insurance companies. And so, as I've told you before, there has long been a government media complex in the United States of America. Right now, the government media complex 99.9% of which is Bolshevik or Leninist or Marxist, whichever you prefer, all three would apply. They are calling you, the average American who are finally standing up to these people, meaning your fraudulent gangster congressman or senator who is trying to rob you of everything your children will make. They nationalized the banks. Then they gave money to their friends on Wall Street. Hank Paulson, for example, robbed hundreds of billions of dollars in TARP funds, in my opinion, and gave them to his friends on Wall Street, much of which is not accounted for. There's no disclosure of where the money went. Many of the people on Wall Street who bankrupted America have now profited from the bankruptcy. They then nationalized the automobile industry, destroying one of America's greatest corporations, General Motors. They are now trying to nationalize health care in America and make it government medicine. And the people said, enough is enough. You're not going to do it. And what do their friends in the media, the low-paid D students known as journalists, do? They call them rowdy. They call them Nazi. They call them fascists for standing up to the true fascists in the United States of America. So understand what's going on in this country and understand what your battle really is and what you have to do. For example, in California, the radical leftists are holding meetings, and the protesters are going there and they're screaming, "This is America. What's wrong with profit?" And the leftist representatives are saying, "Oh my God, we've never seen anything like this." So the Democrat National Committee, the DNC, calls the protesters mobs. They ask Democrats to make lists of people who are showing up at the meetings. They ask Democrats to write down anything that occurs on the internet or on talk radio, I imagine, and make notes of the individuals who are disseminating the truth so that they can then be possibly visited by an Acorn thug with a club somewhere down the line when Obama gets his private personal security force that answers only to him. Right? 1-800-449-8255 is the Savage Nation. MichaelSavage.com is the website. And speaking of which, we've linked up some amazing stories on the website today. Let me point out one of them right now because it's so good. I have to download it. It's a little slow. You know, we got 1.4 million viewers a month on MichaelSavage.com. That represents about 8% of my weekly. Well, I get about 8 to 10 million weekly listeners on the Savage Nation, third largest show in the country, and the website gets about 1.4 million viewers a month. So it's a significant audience. So on the right side of the website, I hope it's still up. I hope it hasn't been removed. I can't download it. There's a picture of Al Franken in the place of a horse's behind, representing the word obotomy or obotomize, which I coined yesterday on the show. I think it was hilarious that the Democrats would take this failed comedian and use him to introduce Judge Sotomayor as she was anointed to the Supreme Court. I thought it was hilarious. It was a double insult. First, they pick an unqualified woman and put her on the Supreme Court simply because she was Hispanic and a woman. And I say that with absolute clarity and no fear for one reason. Because none of you listening to this show can cite one legal paper written by Sotomayor that you can remember. She has not written anything that will ever be remembered in the history of the law. And yet she was pushed forward into the onto the Supreme Court the same way Obama was, even though he has no distinguishing marks in his career. He's never written anything anyone could cite, anything anybody could remember. He was unknown. Again, pushed forward basically for reasons other than qualifications. In other words, so we have an affirmative action president. Now we have an affirmative action Supreme Court justice. So what's actually going on in the United States of America? There is an article from the American Thinker linked up on MichaelSavage.com about Obama, and it is entitled something very interesting, Obama, a Modern-Day Roman Plebeian Tyrant, written by a Dr. Frank Rosenblum, M.D. And he says, many comparisons have been made between the Roman Empire and the United States. The Roman Empire was the most powerful civilization on Earth. Similarly, the United States for now is the sole remaining superpower. However, with the good comes the bad, and the decline and fall of the Roman Empire has been compared to the decline and pending fall of the United States. We often forget the fact that the Roman Empire was preceded for 450 years by the Roman Republic, which arose in 509 BC with the overthrow of the Roman monarchy. So for 450 years, there was a Roman Republic. Now, how old is the American Republic? Do you know, you have any idea? Well, I'll go on. Of course, there's an interesting correlation with the American Revolution, which also overthrew government by monarchy. Rome was structured around a strong constitution, though little of it was written down. The early years of the Republic were marked by political power held by a strong aristocracy descended from earlier royalty. In a series of events very similar to developments in our own country, the Republic devolved into rule by a series of popularly elected political elites who circumvented the Constitution for political purposes. Shall I read on? The Roman Constitution, we read, was a powerful code designed with a complex system of checks and balances and served as a model for our own Constitution. But it eventually was dissolved by professional politicians. And he explains how it was done. And then he talks about plebeians taking over. Many of you know what plebeians are. If you had a reasonable college or high school education, you know what a plebeian is. Then we read around 200 BC, there was an economic crisis similar to the one we are experiencing today. The plebeians, especially farmers, found themselves unable to afford their homes, and they demanded a bailout from the government. When the Senate refused, an uprising occurred, resulting in increased power for the popularly elected plebeian council. The country was then essentially controlled by new plebeian political elites, who were, however, mostly concerned with their own power and not about the problems of the people who elected them. Does that sound familiar to you? As common plebeians fell further into debt, unemployment rose and farmers could no longer sell their produce, resulting in widespread bankruptcy. People began voting for politicians who promised bailouts. Populist leaders emerged who promised change. The final decades of the Roman Republic saw an eerily familiar increase in the dependence of the average Roman citizen on their government, along with tax increases to pay for government programs. The Republic had slowly devolved into a democracy wherein people voted themselves benefits they had not earned. Sound familiar? Now, I'll continue with this brief article on the Savage Nation in a moment, but I want to remind you of something that's very important for you to know. 85% of the American people are covered by health care. Are you aware of the fact that any illegal alien can go into an emergency room in this country and get gold-plated medical treatment for free right now? So who is it, in fact, who is not covered? Who is it that Obama and Feinstein and Boxer and Reid are so anxious to cover? And why are we supposed to pay for health care for people who are not even citizens? Why should we pay for their health care and their children's health care? Why? The answer is we should not. And that, my friends, is why there is anger emerging at the town hall meetings. We know we're being robbed blind by these Bolsheviks, and we're not going to take it anymore. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Come along and be my hearty doll. Come along and be my hearty doll. Come along and be my hearty doll. All my love to you, to you. All my love to you.
All right, so I'm reading from an article called Obama, a Modern-Day Roman Plebeian Tyrant by Frank Rosenblum, MD, in The American Thinker, which I put up on michaelsavage.com, and I'm going to get to the bottom. So there's an economic crisis. The people keep voting themselves raises from the government. There's tax increases. And then slowly the Republic of Rome devolves into a democracy where people vote themselves benefits they didn't earn. Then in 133 BC, Tiberius was elected as tribune. In a move that would be considered Obama-esque, he attempts to spread the wealth by proposing a law that would have limited the amount of land any particular individual could own. And then he redistributes land to the poor, like Mugabe, right? He was later murdered, but his brother was elected and continued to support populist policies that circumvented the Constitution. Then a new political party emerges. The Democratic Populare Party gains power. They regularly break the law in the name of democracy. In a final attempt to reestablish constitutional rule and strengthen the Senate, Lucius Sulla, a member of the conservative Optimate Party, took control as dictator, passed laws to strengthen the Constitution and the Senate, and then resigned. But then another populist movement, like Acorn, arises in about 65 BC to address the problems of the poor. When they were unable to pass all of their reforms legally, they began using illegal methods. Eventually, Julius Caesar, a Populare politician, was installed as dictator in 44 BC, influenced by his greatness as a general and his distribution of benefits, such as food subsidies to the population and free land to his former soldiers. He began appointing officials some today would call czars, Obama's appointed 27 czars. They were named after Russian czars, a word originally derived from the word Caesar. That would not have to be approved by the legislature. But his tenure was cut short by assassination. After Mark Antony was defeated by Octavian at the Battle of Actium in 31 B.C., the Senate gave Octavian extra constitutional powers in 27 B.C., effectively terminating the Roman Republic forever. The summary above is a short synopsis, not a complete history. However, the parallels are unnerving and we can easily see the chilling similarities. Aristotle warned, quote, "Republics decline into democracies and democracies degenerate into despotisms," close quote. The Federalist Papers show us that the Founding Fathers understood this all too well. Just as the Roman Senate became more democratic, so too our own Senate changed from being indirectly elected to direct popular election in 1913. We were founded as a republic, partly because democracies become weaker as they grow, whereas republics can become stronger. Yet we elect populists like Chairman Obama, whose unaffordable promises and unconstitutional actions, after the manner of Tiberius, Caesar, and Octavian, will be recorded in history as the beginning of the end of our republic. We slip further into a democracy of dependence on government and control by it. Inevitably, we too will degenerate into despotism and tyranny, he writes. This has already begun. From antiquity through the present, great thinkers like Aristotle and our founding fathers have warned us of the dangers of repeating the mistakes of prior civilizations. Those who survive us will learn how the selfish majority, at the behest of power-hungry political elites, accepted subjugation in exchange for benefits and thereby sowed the seeds or acorns of our destruction. Barack Obama, plebeian politician to senator to dictator wannabe. The USA, republic to democratic dictatorship and then despotism. It not only can happen, but it will, unless we learn from history and prevent its repetition. Obama, a modern-day Roman plebeian tyrant, written by Dr. Frank Rosenblum. Now, I want to quote something from the preface to my book, The Enemy Within, Saving America from the Liberal Assault on Our Schools, Faith, and Military. Unfortunately, the book I wrote, while it became a bestseller, did not stop the Bolshevik tide that has swept America. I quoted Cicero like this: "A nation can survive its fools and even the ambitious, but it cannot survive treason from within. An enemy at the gates is less formidable, for he is known and carries his banner openly. But the traitor moves amongst those within the gate freely, his sly whispers rustling through all the alleys, heard in the very halls of government itself. For the traitor appears not a traitor. He speaks in accents familiar to his victims, and he wears their face in their arguments. He appeals to the baseness that lies deep in the hearts of all men. He rots the soul of a nation. He works secretly and unknown in the night to undermine the pillars of the city. He infects the body politics that it can no longer resist. A murderer is less to fear." So wrote Roman orator and statesman in 42 B.C. Marcus Tullius Cicero, as quoted by Michael Savage in The Enemy Within. Ladies and gentlemen, I rest my case. I turn it over to you, the people. The phone number here is 1-800-449-8255. Let's take the callers. Orlando, Florida. Rafael, go ahead, please. You're on the Savage Nation.
Sotomayor, she's just as qualified as any Supreme Court justice that's been appointed.
Well, is that because you like it that she's Hispanic, or is it because of something she has written that we can refer to?
It's because that she is qualified. Whatever she's
that's written, because an ignorant. That's because an ignorant man like you says so? Or because she has written something that we should read to say, yes, she is qualified. So, my good friend, tell me what she has written that you can quote me that would qualify her to be on the Supreme Court of the United States of America. Perhaps there's something I missed.
Just like any justice, whereas you can't quote what they have written.
Now you're playing rhetorical games, but you're a kindergartner. You're dealing with a professor. So, at the risk of your displeasure, Raphael, I'm going to tell you that you did not make your case. Go back to the textbooks, Raphael, and get back to me when you can find something that Sotomayor wrote that we could say would make her a Supreme Court justice. You will find nothing, Raphael. The woman has written nothing of any distinction whatsoever. Not a single book, not a single law paper, not a single line that anyone could quote. Raphael, she was picked only because she is Hispanic and a woman. It is a disgrace. She will not bring enlightenment to the Supreme Court. She will bring divisiveness to the Supreme Court.
Savage.
Do bopsy do, boom 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 boom. Do bopsy do, boom 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 boom.
I'll always want you because my heart is true. Come 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 closer, and I'll tell you all.
It is the Savage Nation. Now I have said that Sotomayor, who was just put on the Supreme Court, was picked only because she's a woman and a Hispanic. I'm sure she's a nice person. I mean, she came from my borough of the Bronx, and like myself, she was poor. And she pulled herself up by her bootstraps. But unlike me, she did it with a little help from her friends. I didn't have people pulling strings for me. She did. Because, as you well know, liberals have felt that they need to push unqualified people into positions of power for very, very, very diverse reasons, which I won't go into right now. A caller said she's as qualified as all of the others on the Supreme Court because he was an ignorant man who had no education and doesn't understand what the Supreme Court is. And he said to me, well, can you quote anything anyone else in the Supreme Court has ever written? Yes, I can, sir. I didn't have time in the last segment. There was a Supreme Court justice named Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. You probably didn't read about him because you were perhaps reading Jenny Has Two Mommies when you went to the fifth grade. But Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., who lived between 1841 and 1935, was on the U.S. Supreme Court, as I said. And in a series of opinions after the First World War, he held that the freedom of expression guaranteed by federal and state constitutions declared a common law privilege that we are entitled to, except in cases where the expression and the circumstances in which it uttered posed a, quote, clear and present danger, those are his words, of causing some harm that the legislature had properly forbidden. And a later case announced the Holmes Doctrine, declared that the First Amendment would not protect a person, quote, falsely shouting fire in a theater and causing a panic. So that's where the phrase, you cannot shout fire in a crowded movie theater, came from. Unlike Sotomayor, who has written nothing that anyone knows about. Then there was Louis Brandeis, after whom a university is named. He lived between 1856 and 1941. Brandeis was a Supreme Court justice and one of the most influential justices ever to serve on it. And his opinions, according to legal scholars, are some of the greatest defenses of freedom of speech and the right to privacy ever written by a member of a high court. And you have to read some of the opinions to understand them. And I'm not going to quote any of them to you because, well, I'll read one of them. He wrote, fear of serious injury cannot alone justify suppression of free speech and assembly. He wrote, men feared witches and burnt women. It is the function of free speech to free men from bondage of irrational fears. Those who won our independence by revolution were not cowards. They did not fear political change. They did not exalt order at the cost of liberty. That's what Louis Brandeis wrote. Thus far, we have seen nothing written by Mrs. Sotomayor that anyone can quote, and I doubt we ever will see anything written by Sotomayor. This is the Savage Nation to show you what the crooks in Washington are doing to you. Remember when the auto giants came to Washington to answer the wonderful esteemed members of Congress? They were forced to fly commercial. They were told to give up their private jets by the falsely indignant members of Congress. How dare you fly to Washington at a time like this when the American people are demanding belt tightening, said Nancy Pelosi. Remember? Well, Congress has just agreed to spend $550 million to buy themselves 8 more airplanes to fly around the country and the world. That's so Miss Pelosi and Mrs. Feinstein and I suppose Mrs. Boxer don't have to fly first class on United to go to Washington because it's a stress. So they want a new Gulfstream 550. So they told the Air Force to go and buy brand new 550s. The Air Force didn't even want them. The Air Force had initially requested an appropriations bill that only included one Gulfstream 5, and one business class equivalent of a Boeing 737 to replace aging planes. The Defense Department also asked to buy two additional 737s that were being leased. But lawmakers in the House under Nancy Pelosi, who really likes G550s, added funds to buy those planes and additional funds to buy an additional two 737s and two additional Gulfstream 5 planes so that she and her children and her husband, I suppose, can go back and forth and forth and back and back and forth and forth and back in a Gulfstream 550 or a Boeing 737. But don't think it's limited to the Democrats. I would be unfair if I led you to believe that. This month, for example, we read in the Wall Street Journal, 11 separate congressional delegations are going through Germany. House Minority Leader John Boehner of Ohio is leading five of the lawmakers on a trip around the world. Senator Richard Shelby, Republican Alabama, is taking a group of senators and their spouses to Europe for 3 weeks. When Boehner was asked what they were doing there, he said he couldn't comment for security reasons. A spokesmouth for Shelby said the same. Now, once the travel is approved by congressional committees, that's, of course, a rubber stamp, the lawmaker who is leading a delegation can decide whether to fly on a commercial airline or to request a business jet from the Department of Defense. Lawmakers typically fly on military jets, where members of the armed services carry bags and take drink orders. But when flying on military jets, lawmakers are permitted to bring along spouses at no cost. I am convinced that very shortly you will read that children and spouses will be flying on the Boeing 550s and the 737s just purchased by Pelosi and Reid. If you remember, they were the ones who raised some questions about the auto leaders coming in on their private jets. Congress treats the American taxpayer like an all-you-can-eat buffet. Pelosi and Reid, you need to put yourself on a diet or we'll do it for you in 2010, writes a listener, writes a reader to the Wall Street Journal named Lynn Marino. Congress treats the American taxpayer like an all-you-can-eat buffet. Pelosi and Reid, you need to put yourself on a diet or we'll do it for you in 2010, says Lynn Marino. There's nothing I can say that has not been said other than read Animal Farm. In addition to reading Animal Farm, where the animals take over the farm, I suggest you pick up a copy of Sinclair Lewis's great book, It Can't Happen Here. Sinclair Lewis wrote It Can't Happen Here back in 1935. And it was a time when fascist governments were appearing in Europe and in the Soviet Union. Stalin in Russia, the fascist dictator Stalin in Russia, the fascist dictator Hitler in Germany, they were arising. And Sinclair Lewis wrote a book called It Can't Happen Here, meaning it will never happen in America, or will it? Well, he feared it could happen here, but he feared it would be a right-wing dictatorship that would emerge in the United States of America. But if you actually read what he said would happen when Senator Winthrop, the right-winger, took over America, you will find out that it matches very closely what Senator Obama has already done in America in less than 7 months. One, all finance in the country, including banking, insurance, stocks, and bonds and mortgages, shall be under the absolute control of a federal central bank. Now, notice the healthcare debate. Obama has taken over the banks. You notice that? Now he wants to take over the insurance industry. He's saying it's health insurance industry now, but no, he wants the entire insurance industry in his hands. So he's following the footsteps of the dictator as described by Sinclair Lewis. Then he, in point number two, he appoints a commission that answers only to him. And then in five, annual net income per person shall be limited to $500,000. Remember, this is in 1935. No accumulated fortune may at any one time exceed $3 million per person. Remember, 1935 dollars. No one person shall, during his entire lifetime, be permitted to retain an inheritance or various inheritances in total exceeding $2 million, again in 1935 dollars. All incomes or estates in excess of the sums named shall be seized by the federal government for use in relief and administrative expenses. I don't have to go on because Everything he predicted in this book, well, up to 80% of it, that he said would happen under a right-wing dictatorship is happening under the left-wing dictatorship of Obama. So if he says annual net income shall be limited to $500,000 a year, that was in 1935 dollars, that would be the equivalent, I would say, of, I would pick a number of 20 times that, which would be, say, 10 times that is 5 million, 20 times that would be 10, 20, how much would that be? 10 times is 5 million, 20 times would be 10 million. So he would say, maybe Obama would say in years to come, annual net income cannot exceed $10 million. No accumulated fortune may at any time exceed $3 million per person. So he might say it's now $60 million per person. So the average person will say, well, what's wrong with that? Why should anyone have more than $60 million? The answer is they earned it. They didn't take it from you, you lousy bum, you. You loser who can't even get out of the starting gate. You want their money, you loser. You get trapped in the starting gate like a horse who crapped on himself, and you don't want the thoroughbred to win the race, do you? You're stuck in the starting gate all your life, and you blame it on someone else. It's because you crapped on yourself in the starting gate. Don't blame everyone else. There are horses who didn't crap on themselves in the starting gate. They ran around the track. Some of them won, some wouldn't play show. But you're jealous, aren't you? And that's exactly what happens when you have a plebeian dictator emerging. Let's go to the callers. Cindy and Modesto, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. You're talking about drugs and how many people are on drugs earlier in the show, and I just wanted to tell you I feel like a drug addict, and my drug of choice is Michael Savage.
Well, maybe I should be outlawed because I'm addictive. They could declare me.
Maybe.
They could call the DEA on me and say that you are disseminating addictive speech.
Therefore
you're a threat to the government. And the hemlock will be coming from the government very shortly, and you'll have a choice to either drink the hemlock or go off the air.
Oh, no, I'm going to miss you. I've been on vacation. I have to go back to work, but I'll get to
All right,
now.
Well, take the radio and little earphones to work. Thank you for the call. Now, as promised for my loyal listeners, I got a letter this morning from my lawyer in London that was sent to him on the 5th of August, 2009, from the Communist Socialist Labour Government of England that has put me in a list with murderers and terrorists simply for expressing myself. And I'm not going to read the whole letter to you, but listen to what this jerk in the government of Gordon Brown writes. Dear sir, regarding Michael Savage, challenge to exclusion decision. And he says, we feel that his statements fall clearly within the terms of the unacceptable behavior policy. Now, I don't know what this policy is. We've never seen it. And then he says, your client, Michael Savage, must repudiate what he said. Listen to this. You're not going to believe it. Any such repudiation must be genuine and comprehensive, and persuade my client, meaning the government, that this is a true shift of position, in which case my client would be prepared to consider this. In other words, if I repudiate what I didn't say, they might take me off the list. They then go on to say, you make reference to an article in the Daily Mail on Sunday, July 19th, in which it was apparently reported that my client, meaning the government of England, was in the process of revisiting the question of the publication of excluded persons. My client has confirmed that there is no truth in the article and that the policy continues, as does the principle of disclosing the names of excluded individuals. Yours faithfully, Treasury Solicitors Department of the Government of the United Kingdom. We don't know who that individual is. He's an unnamed hack in the government, again, repeating the big lie. So my lawyer writes back to him as follows. Dear sirs, regarding Michael Savage, quote, you state in your letter that, quote, the statements which were cited in our letter dated July 109 were taken out of context. We disagree. And we note that you have not provided the context in which you say the remarks were made. Firstly, says my lawyer, there were no statements cited in your letter dated July 1. And he goes on and says, we assume you mean your letter to us dated May 29. Secondly, on the basis of what you state, we assume that your client is now confirming his concerns to Extract A in the 29th letter, in which there is only one statement which could conceivably be considered to relate to this issue. And then he says, in fact, the context of that extract was clearly explained at paragraph 11 of our letter to you, meaning he was trying to say that I never said what they claim I said. Indeed, in light of what was stated in that paragraph, where as well as explaining the context, we made it clear that Savage does not believe that it is right to kill any Muslims. It is simply outrageous that you suggest that either we or our clients should, quote, justify calling for the murder of Muslims, close quote. As we have made clear, that is not something our client would ever seek to do, which is true. I never said it. Moreover, we ask that you explain how our client can repudiate views which are not his own, and why he should satisfy your client there, that there has been a, quote, true shift in his position, when the only issue has been the misunderstanding by your client as to what Savage's views are. To ask Savage to do so is plainly oppressive. We have explained to you that his true views, what his true views are, and have given you every assurance about his conduct if he were to come to the UK. And he goes on and on and on in a long letter, which he concludes with reference to the New Yorker article. And he says, we also wish to draw your attention to a profile of Michael Savage, which was published in the August 3rd edition of the New Yorker magazine, recently a copy of which we attached. As you will be aware, the New Yorker is one of the most respected magazines in the world, and has over the years profiled many acclaimed artists, writers, and actors. We also invite you to listen to the audio interview with the author of the article, Mr. Khalefa Sena, on the New Yorker website. Mr. Sena's article has already received positive feedback for the New Yorker readership, and he cites some of the positive feedback. And he says, Mr. Sena is plainly independent and politically no natural supporter of the views of our client. Nonetheless, he has taken to trouble to carry out detailed research about Savage and formed a balanced view. This is wholly different to the approach of the Home Office in selecting a few random extracts of what our client has stated out of context, from which it has formed a deeply misleading impression of our client. As stated by the author of the New Yorker article, quote, the immoderate quotes meticulously cataloged by the liberal media watchdog site, MediaMatters.org, are accurate but misleading insofar as they reduce a willfully erratic broadcast to a series of political brickbats, close quote. Then my lawyer concludes by saying, accordingly, we ask your client, review this material carefully and give it very significant weight. It would be, in our view, truly extraordinary if the Home Secretary considered it appropriate to maintain the exceptional and draconian decision to exclude Savage from the UK in light of an assessment in these terms. Yours faithfully, my lawyer. Now, wait, I can't take the break. You got to give me 30 more seconds. I address this to the hundreds or thousands of you who have followed this case of an innocent man being crucified by an illegitimate government in England. I want you to go to michaelsavage.com and check out the Savage Legal Fund. And if you believe in free speech, act accordingly. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Goodness gracious, great balls of fire. I let it love what I thought it was funny. You came along and moved me, honey. I've changed my mind. This love is fine. Goodness gracious, great balls of fire. Kisses, baby.
So we've gone from the comic to the serious. As you can see, my crime was speaking for you. And as a result, the evil left-wing government of England, the so-called Labour government, which is really a socialist-slash-communist illegitimate regime in England, has put me on a list of people who are not permitted to enter England, alongside people who have committed murder. Now, you may hate what I say, but I want you to think very carefully before you cheer that I've been banned in England. If they can ban a person for speaking, let us say, saying things that they don't approve of. And remember, I've never called for violence, or I wouldn't be on the radio for 15 years. I wouldn't have lasted 15 minutes had I called for violence. I have never called for violence. They're liars. And the woman who put me on this list, Jackie Smith, was thrown out of her job because 80% of the British people are on my side. There will be a conservative victory in England when elections are held next year. There's going to be a monster right-wing conservative government swept into power, and they will sweep out the communist socialist Labour government onto the dustbin of history. Perhaps a Thatcher-like figure will emerge again. I don't know. And I'm pretty sure that with your help and my legal work, which is desperately expensive, I will have my name removed from the list. They will send me a letter of apology. I will go to England with a shipload of supporters, and I will speak either before Parliament or at the either the Oxford Union or one of the other great debating societies. So hang in there. I'm not giving up so fast. Because what happens to me will happen to you, I can guarantee it. What happens to me will happen to you. It doesn't matter whether you're a liberal or not.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Well, here's what we've talked about today on the Savage Nation. I disclosed only to my audience, no one has seen these yet, two letters. One is from the British government under the current Labour/Socialist administration, which confirms in writing that I have not been taken off the list and continues the lie against Michael Savage. They refuse to remove me from the list of excluded individuals with murderers and terrorists. And then we talked about my lawyer's letter back to them, refuting every word in this incredible smear campaign being conducted by the Labour Socialist Government of England. We also talked about the Real Americans standing up and the Week in Review. Real Americans finally stood up, not welfare recipients, not illegal aliens, but actual working Americans. If you looked at some of the videos of these town hall meetings, you'll see them, well-dressed, solid citizens taking time off from work, standing up to the Obama-style union thugs. And these people took time off, as I said, to make their voices heard. They were not acorn workers hired by Obama. We also did a week in review. It was quite a week. Started out with a bang when real Americans began standing up at town hall meetings and shouting out against an administration gone mad with power. We heard the rising anger at a town hall meeting, first with the traitor Senator Arlen Specter.
When you have a bill, and we have a lot of them, but there are 1,000 pages, it's a case my tax staff, and we divide up the bill. We have to make judgments very fast. We give it out.
Then, of course, Bill Clinton went to North Korea and gave away the store to Kim Jong-il, the dictator murderer, and came back with the two prisoners that the madman had sentenced to hard labor.
I was very pleased to get the news that my husband's plane had taken off from Pyongyang with the two young women on board. They are on their way to California.
I told you that I believe this was a power play by Hillary and her husband attempting to undermine Obama. Because they want to regain power. And then, of course, this week, there was the confirmation of Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court. And boy, did Dianne Feinstein and Chuck Schumer make asses of themselves about this.
I think it's truly a great day for the United States Supreme Court. I think it's a great day for the law. I think it's a great day for justice. I think it's a great day for every young woman out there.
She's not just going to be another vote. She's not just going to be another voice. She's going to be a real leader that will lead this court back to the mainstream, which is what this country needs.
I'm not sure if you understand what's happening in America right now. I don't know if you know that average working Americans just like you are standing up against Obama's plan for a socialist America through his health care plan. They're appearing at town hall meetings all across America. Now, the idea of a town hall meeting used to be just a political front for pre-selected audience members repeating the same old lines. But somehow real people and real voters got involved and got vocal and got in the faces of these phony politicians. Listen to the voices of anger across America. This is from a town hall meeting in Tampa, Florida. These are average voters. What they're saying is open up the doors. Open up the doors. the congresswoman's thugs tried to shut them out. Listen to this average woman. She was outraged.
I'm angry because I've been standing here watching people come through the back door while I stand through here in the front door. And I've been told over and over again, no, you can't come in with the door slammed in my face. I'm even a taxpayer. I paid for this building. What's this about?
Now here's St. Louis, Missouri. Listen to a town hall meeting where a bunch of union thugs beat up a black conservative. Did that make it to your local paper? I doubt it.
I don't want to get involved in that for that at all.
Where's the ACLU and the Southern Poverty Law Center crying racism? I guess when the black man happens to be a conservative, it isn't racism. Here's the man, Kenneth Gladney, talking about being beaten up by Obama's union thugs.
I was setting up, actually, to pass out the Don't Tread on Me flags. A priest wife, she walked up to me, and I was kind of showing her some of the merchandise that we had, that I had there at the time. And this guy, he walked up to me and said, who in the blank is selling this blank here? And I said, sir, this is my merchandise, and, would you like a flag or something like that? And he was like, what kind of N are you to be giving out this kind of stuff here? And he snatched the button board. And when he snatched the button board, I snatched it back from him. And that's when he proceeded to hit me in my face. After that, another member of his organization ran up and he starts hitting me in my face as well. I fell to the floor. And another guy from their organization, taller guy, Caucasian, he began to grab me by my collar, by my neck, and he hit me in my face on the left side and knocked me back to the floor. And that's when a woman started kicking me in the back of my head and in my back.
What's happening in America today is very frightening. I guess some ideologies are more equal than others. But here's the most horrible piece of all. Obama's saying that he wants those who disagree with him on health care to get out of the way.
We've got some work to do. I don't mind, by the way, being responsible. I expect to be held responsible for these issues because I'm the president. But I don't want the folks who created the mess. I don't want the folks created the mess, do a lot of talking. I want them just to get out of the way so we can clean up the mess. I don't mind cleaning up after them, but don't do a lot of talking. Am I wrong, Virginia?
Pave him over, Obama? A naked neo-Marxist. A naked dictator. I'll be right back.
Savage.
You know, America has, I'm sorry to tell you, a love affair with stories about organized crime. Recently, I've been reading a series in the L.A. Times about organized crime's attempt to move into L.A. in the 50s and the incredible police squad that was formed to stop it. These were tough guys. They were all ex-military. The leader of them was the toughest guy, that is the police, a former B-25 pilot. It's fascinating to see what happened and how they kept the mafia, by and large, out of L.A. What a series. Joining us today is Paul Lieberman, who wrote these stories for the L.A. Times. Mr. Lieberman, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on today.
How did you become involved with this kind of story?
Well, I was a longtime editor and roving cultural correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, but I also did these way outside the box special projects that took me into murky netherworlds, and this was one in a series of them where I got lost in some far off realm of cops and crooks and moral craziness.
What made you decide to do such an extensive story about the Los Angeles gangster scene?
Well, number one, anything called the gangster squad, I want to know about it. This fell into my lap in a way, and part of
sometimes inspiration is knowing when you leap at something. I was sitting around. We had published a story about history of the Los Angeles Police Department or certain aspects of it. And I'm sitting there, and I get a phone call. This is 1992. Okay, this is a long time. Some of your listeners probably were still in grade school then. 1992, I get a call, older man. He says, "You left something out." "What do you mean we left something out?" "You didn't mention the gangster squad." This had been talking about certain areas of the LAPD. I said, "The gangster squad, how do you know about that?" And he paused and said, "Well, I was on it." Well, I'd never heard of a gangster squad, much less a guy calling me in saying he was on it. And I basically said, "What are you doing tomorrow afternoon? I'll be in your house." And the next day I was in the living room, or then a couple of days later, of this long retired LAPD sergeant, Jack O'Mara, who had been part of the original eight members of this squad formed right after World War II. I mean, all these guys were classic children of the Depression. They all fought in the war. They came back to the LAPD where they'd been before. And they got recruited to this very secretive squad, almost like Mission Impossible. You do not exist. If you get caught, you're on your own. That was formed to basically scare these mobsters out of town, do anything it took. I mean, it was one of these times where Los Angeles had never had success going through the sort of following the rules and going through the channels. The first 50 years of the 20th century, when they eventually tallied every single mob killing, they had gotten a conviction in one of them, and that conviction had fallen apart. They got the wrong guy. So they'd gone 50 years without ever having a conviction in a mob killing, and they were just infuriated by these mobsters who kind of came from Chicago, New York, Cleveland, and made themselves at home in L.A., and they had recruited this fellow, Jack O'Mara, and some other very tough and clever cops for this thankless, secretive job of giving the hoods back some terror, giving them their own medicine, and drive them out of town, do whatever it takes, and that's the story. And after I had spoken to O'Mara, over the following years, I tracked down nine other members of this squad, including all the surviving originals. One, the original bug man on the unit, would not talk to me for 10 years. And then one day he started answering questions, too. And later on, I also made contact with some associates of Mickey Cohen, who was the main hoodlum in the story, the main target. And then there was one of Mickey's rivals was a fellow named Jack the Enforcer Whalen, kind of a one-man Irish gang. I guess it's not politically correct today to define people by ethnicities, but the gangs were defined by ethnicities. And Whalen kind of was a rival of Mickey Cohen, and in a shooting in the last days of the 1950s, literally ending an era, he went into a restaurant to confront Mickey and was shot between the eyes. That's kind of the culmination of many, many years of attempts by the gangster squad to nail Mickey Cohen, and it all comes to a head with the shooting. Anyway, I also found relatives of his who were willing to talk about his side of things. So that really was it, basically lining up the cast of characters, and then you have them tell their stories. And then you go, and I got thousands of pages of documents, because you never know when someone tells a story. It may be a great story. Is it true? And you try to check that out by getting other witnesses to attest to it and get every single document you could get your hands on, probation reports, death certificates, grand jury testimony. And after 50, 60 years, you have to dig these things out of very dusty, musty, murky archives and hope you can get some. But I found war letters written by some of these characters. I found handwritten letters by a mobster and his family to a judge, family pictures. And, you know, then you throw it all up in the air and hope it lands in one cohesive story and share it with your audience.
You describe the relationships not just with the gangster squad, but the gangsters themselves as being very convoluted as well.
Well, I mean, they fight each other for control of lucrative rackets. And in earlier eras, they fought over, in L.A., for instance, they fought over fruit carts. I mean, we're talking about the turn of the century. And then they fought over liquor. I mean, prohibition, there was huge dollars. And, you know, we know what happened in Chicago, right? The fights over control of the liquor trades. Well, the same thing happened in Los Angeles, and that was the next phase of things. And then finally, the illegal gambling came in, the bookmaking, the racing wire services, and control of that became another reason to fight. And you had these crews, as I said, you had the traditional Italian mafia, led by a guy named Jack Dragna. You had Mickey Cohen, who was a former boxer, and he was had met the Capones when he lived and boxed out of the Midwest. But he was originally born in Brooklyn, and he'd spent some time in L.A. And he was an associate of Bugsy Siegel. He came to L.A. as Bugsy's kind of gopher and muscle man and then worked his way up. And when Bugsy was murdered, while reading the Los Angeles Times, by the way, Mickey became the chief rival of Jack Dragna for control of the rackets in Los Angeles. But Mickey, interestingly enough, was, I mean, say that dumb hoodlum, I say dumb in a certain sense, most hoodlums and crooks are dumb, of course, but he was stupid in the sense that many of the gangsters in history have had at least enough brains to know you don't wave for attention. You don't say, looky, looky, here I am, here's what I'm doing. You don't parade around. I mean, you may parade around, but you don't invite the columnists and the gossip people and the Hollywood people to dine with you all over the Sunset Strip. Well, Al Capone did that a little bit. He loved being the public personality. More recently, in our times, John Gotti was that way, right? He loved the Dapper Don business and getting the attention and wearing the clothes. Well, Mickey Cohen in L.A. was that in spades. He would ride around with his, they called him the Seven Dwarves, were his crew, and they'd ride in this caravan of Cadillacs, and every night they'd be out on the Sunset Strip. So he waved for attention. And he became the sort of target of the gangster squad. I mean, Mickey so flaunted what he did. And not only was that stupid, but Mickey would taunt the police. I mean, he called this squad the Stupidity Squad. He called the police chief of Los Angeles, who became one of the famous figures in law enforcement, Chief Parker, called him a degenerate. Then the head of this unit in the 50s was a fellow who went on to be head of security for the NFL, Captain Hamilton. He called him a degenerate, too. I mean, you don't go out in public and call the guys who control an army that can come get you. You don't call them degenerates in public. But he did, so the war was on.
Well, this is a fascinating story. Can you stay with us through the break?
I will be delighted to stay on, Michael.
I'll be right back. This is the Savage Nation.
Savage.
We're back with Paul Lieberman from the L.A. Times, talking about his series of stories covering the gangster squad that stopped the penetration of organized crime into Los Angeles when cops could be cops. So how successful was the LAPD's gangster squad?
Well, let me tell you some of the things they did, which is what's interesting. I mean, as I told you before, they went, when they tallied it up, it was shocking. They had not gotten the conviction in a mob killing in 50, 60 years, not one that stuck. So what they did is, you know, they resorted to other means. They would take the hoodlums up in the hills, and one of my cops would put a gun in the ear of these guys and tell them, this isn't Cleveland, this isn't Detroit, this isn't New York, this isn't Chicago, and maybe you want to go back home. And then I loved the line. He'd stick a gun, and he'd ask him, what did you say? Well, maybe I said, do you want to sneeze? Do you feel a sneeze coming on, a real loud sneeze? And this would be at night up in the hills, and the idea was maybe that would convince the guy to go back home. With Jack Dragna, who was the head of the Italian mafia, I mean, he was unlike Mickey. He kept to himself and didn't draw attention to himself, and they never could. They couldn't get bugs close to him. So what they did is they bugged the headboard of the bed of his mistress. He had a mistress. They broke into her apartment, stuck a bug right in the sun pattern. She had a sunburst pattern in her headboard. Put the bug right in the sun, drilled a hole back in the wall, you know, led a line down to the basement, and they listened in while he and his mistress did their thing. And this guy was a mafia boss, and he was trying to kill Mickey Cohen for years, and he killed, a lot of bodies were falling in that era. Never could get him for murder. You know what they got him for? Lewd conduct based on the bug in his headboard.
Ha-ha.
I mean, that was typical of you got what victories you could. And I will give you one more story, Michael. One of my main cops, frustrated in their inability to get Mickey Cohen, convinced one of Mickey's guards at his home to quit and to suggest to Mickey that he hire someone else in his place, a guy who had great credentials, who had been a munitions expert in the war. And this other fellow happened to be Sergeant Jack O'Mara's paid informant. That's how O'Mara got a guard inside Mickey's home. Literally, Mickey was one of Mickey's security guards in this well-protected home with searchlights and a fortified window with a little porthole in it. And so one day, the cop gets the guard to convince Mickey that his guns could use a cleaning and test firing. The guard takes all of Mickey's guns out of the home, brings them to the police firing range, takes off the butt plates, etches his initials under the butt plates, puts the butt plates back on, gives them to Mickey's guard, who brings them back to Mickey. Mickey says, oh, thank you very much for doing this, and, you know, hey, he has the guns back. Well, they've now planted a trap for Mickey Cohen. If his guns ever show up at a murder, they'll know they're his. Of course, they're not registered to him, no surprise. And the trap was set, and it took 10 years for those guns to show up at a murder, but they did. And it was at the murder of Jack the Enforcer Whalen, who is this other one-man Irish gang. So that's some of the stuff they did.
Were these rough tactics effective?
In a way, on the surface, if you looked at getting convictions, they finally did get a conviction in a gang murder. Whether it was the right guy or not, you have to read the material to see whether that's the case. But finally, the first time in the 20th century, they did. But what happened in the courts was trivial to what happened outside the courts. And the most significant thing was that L.A. never developed a mafia like there was back east. In fact, it later was derided as a Mickey Mouse mafia. And the case could be made that these guys were partially responsible for that. I mean, they sort of convinced the mob that L.A. was not a very hospitable place. So I think in the end, they had that satisfaction.
The gangster squad's image had a little help from the media in Hollywood back then, I guess.
Well, I will tell you. I mean, again, there's what the public sees, the civilians. You know, and of course, our society is the same way today. You're given a certain picture by any institution. We're all like this, by the way. And it's not just police departments. It's not just politicians. It's not just those of us in the media. I mean, in some ways, we present the public image, and then there's what goes on behind the scenes. There were two things that really changed the image of the LAPD in the 1950s. I mean, it had been a horribly corrupt department, and it really did gain the reputation as the most professional in the country. Two things changed it. Number one was this Chief Parker, who had been in charge of the detention facilities for the Germans at Normandy in the war, and he was a lawyer, and he was into internal affairs. He was a tough guy, and he really imposed a new military discipline on the LAPD. They looked good. They were trained. They were educated. That was one thing that helped promote the image of the LAPD, and rightfully so. The second thing was Dragnet. First, it was a radio show, and then a great TV show. And it was started by this guy, Jack Webb, who was a young actor, producer, and it was about two very by-the-book kind of yes-ma'am cops. The famous line was, just the facts, ma'am. And Jack Webb, who played Sergeant Friday, and his partner, would go through the cases. Well, the LAPD, seeing that this burnished their image, always provided Jack Webb with their files. And in fact, the one time he made a movie based on Dragnet in 1954 was actually based on a case handled by the gangster squad, then was being called intelligence, in which he, one of the main characters was the head of it, Captain Hamilton, Chief Parker, and they were huge hero characters. Well, meanwhile, here's the realpolitik. Here's how the world works. Jack Webb was married to one of the great sexy singers of the day, this woman, Julie London, and very few people today would remember her, but if you're old enough, you remember her, and I invite people to Google her, because she was, you know, really the item. She was absolutely sexy and slinky and sultry and the whole deal. Well, they were married, and then they went the way of Hollywood, and we're getting a divorce. So here's how the world works. He calls up the chief of police. His show Dragnet is, you know, doing wonders for the LAPD. Says, I'm going through this hairy divorce, and can you guys give me a little help? Can you send over one of the bug men? And I tell the story. One of the bug men recalls being sent over, and Webb had his own private eye and wanted help to bug his wife, who he was going through this very costly divorce with. And that's sort of what happened. I mean, he did them a favor, and they did him a favor. So there's the realpolitik of the world. And, you know, Jack Webb, to the end of his days, was still creating great pictures of the LAPD. Later on, he produced, you know, the Adam, what was the name of that TV show, that also, you know, presented cops as these really kind of square-by-the-book guys. And in reality, they were somewhat square. They believed the world was black and white, but they were not quite as pure as the TV image would suggest.
What ultimately became of the men of the gangster squad?
Well, people, civilians, what I call them, who hear what these guys did, took hoodlums up into the hills, and I always say, what do you think these guys did when they retired? First of all, let me say, none of them retired with glory, in a way. You do the dirty job. This is the same in the military, in any kind of institution like this. You really give them the dirty job. You know, in the end, they don't make you heroes. Some of the bosses get credit for this, but the ones who are insulated from the dirty work that you do in these jobs, and almost all felt they weren't appreciated. They slunk out of the LAPD when they could retire. One of my main cops was sent to the jail for his final years. I mean, jail duty, et cetera, et cetera. So all the guys kind of retired somewhat bitter about their police careers, and I will ask what I call civilians, well, what do you think they did in their lives? And most of them say, well, maybe they could have been security guards or something like that. I can't tell you how wrong they were. The most roguish of my cops, the one who went furthest over the line and sort of developed an alliance with this mobster called the Enforcer, he became a multimillionaire businessman. I mean, he helped contractors put in garage doors, security systems, everything under the sun, developed shopping centers, had residential properties. He became multimillionaire with a house on the beach, sat in his backyard, and he kind of joked in his later days that his police pension paid his liquor bill, and he'd sit back there with his buddies and watch the shapely young beach girls go by. That was one of them. A couple of others became fabulously rich, also were very clever. One of the bug men, the one who did a favor for Jack Webb, guess what he did? Went to law school, became a lawyer, then became a judge. Got training at Oxford, tried murder cases. The bug man became one of the most distinguished judges in L.A. Finally, the guy who took the hoodlums up in the hills, he became head of racetrack security for the two big racetracks in L.A. County. And that was kind of interesting. But he also had a daughter who was particularly bright. And the daughter of the cop who took hoodlums up in the hills got a Ph.D. in business affairs and real estate from Harvard and taught at Harvard. So, I mean, it was these guys really were the best and the brightest. I mean, as I said, they had been through the war. They'd been through the Depression. In another era, I'm not sure what they would have done in younger life. But police work in that era was well-paid. It was secure. And it attracted these very brave and brilliant guys. So afterwards, I mean, I say that's really justice. While they had those careers, Mickey Cohen died a cripple in his early 60s with an estate of $3,000. So really, I mean, Mickey died a kind of languishing death, and the cops really distinguished themselves. So they showed what they were made of.
Paul Lieberman, thanks for being on the Savage Nation. Fascinating series.
Michael, thank you very much for listening to all my blather. Check out our Gangster Squad stories on the LA Times website.
This is the Savage Nation. Be here or be nowhere.
Savage.
Iran continues to be a problem for the Obama administration, despite Obama's attempt to open the lanes of communication. Joining us now is KT McFarland from ktmcfarland.com to give us an update on Iran and their nuclear aspirations.
Hi, Michael. It's great to be with you again. You know, Michael, I think our most pressing national security priority has to be to stop Iran from developing nuclear weapons. So far, nothing the Obama administration has tried has worked. Frankly, nothing the Bush administration tried and worked either. During the campaign, Obama promised tough, direct diplomacy to deal with Iran. And then he actually offered that hand of friendship three times, in his inaugural address, in his address to the Iranian people, and in his Cairo speech. And each time it was rebuffed by the mullahs. So he did Plan B. Now, Plan B was to enlist Russian support to stop Iran's nuclear program, since they're a critical element in Iran developing and enriching uranium. But Obama came home from Moscow empty-handed just 2 weeks ago. So what's his plan C? Well, one idea would be continue to hope that American diplomacy and Russian cooperation will eventually kick in, and yet at the same time Iran moves inexorably toward nuclear weapons. Another idea would be let Israel attack Iran's nuclear facilities. And what seems to be their preferred option, accept Iranian atomic weapons as a fait accompli, while extending the U.S. nuclear umbrella over Israel and the moderate Arab states, which is what Secretary Clinton mentioned a few weeks ago. Well, none of these three are great options. First, there is nothing to indicate that Iran or Russia will change their minds in the near term, and why should they? The longer Iran strings the U.S. along, the closer they come to possessing nuclear weapons and becoming the dominant power in the region. And even if Russia were to reverse course suddenly and stop aiding Iran's nuclear program, it's not clear whether they would have much of an impact or whether they're willing to at this point. And the second option, an Israeli attack on Iran's nuclear facilities, which the Israelis are seriously considering before the end of the year.
There are a number of inherent risks with that option, though, aren't there?
It would be logistically complicated. Israeli bombers would have to fly 1,000 miles, evading the air defense systems of Iraq, Turkey, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and strike multiple dispersed targets. Many of them are hardened or buried deep underground. At best, Israel would set back Iran's nuclear program just a few years, and it would risk setting off further regional conflict. An Israeli attack might put their close relationship to the U.S. in jeopardy, especially were they to attack without President Obama's prior approval, which he is very unlikely to give. Now, recently, Secretary Clinton and others have hinted at the third option. If Iran's nuclear program cannot be stopped, could it be contained? That means they would accept Iran having nuclear weapons. And they feel that could we try a Middle East version of Cold War deterrence, where the U.S. pledges nuclear retaliation if Iran attacks Israel? Well, this option is problematic as well. First of all, is it realistic to think the American public will risk nuclear war to protect Tel Aviv or Riyadh? And similarly, it would be very cold comfort to Israel to know that America promises to annihilate Tehran if Tehran makes good on President Ahmadinejad's weekly pledge to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. Well, what does Israel care if they're obliterated, whether the United States retaliates? Defense Secretary Gates, in fact, was in Israel just last week trying to sell that idea, accept a nuclear Iran, we'll protect you with our nuclear umbrella. But the Israelis completely rejected it. So back to the drawing table. Furthermore, if Shiite Persian Iran is allowed to develop nuclear weapons, what about the Sunni Arab states in the region? Don't Saudi Arabia and Egypt and others conclude that they need nuclear weapons of their own? And since money is no object for many of these Muslim petrostates, a nuclear Iran could set off an arms race. A nuclear arms race, Michael, in the single most unstable, dangerous part of the world. And finally, there's that issue of terrorists. Iran has very close ties to terrorist groups throughout the world, but particularly in the Middle East, Hezbollah and Hamas. What happens to those Iranian nuclear weapons? Could they find their way into the hands of terrorists, surrogates who would have no compunction or restraint to use them against Israel or the United States.
None of these options seem very realistic, KT.
At this rate, if we don't come up with something fast, Iran will have nuclear weapons in the next 12 to 18 months, certainly by the end of Obama's first term. So what do? Lean back and accept it or do something? Well, I think we do have some leverage, and that's gasoline. Iran may be the world's fourth largest oil exporter, but it doesn't refine that oil, and it still has to import 40% of its gasoline. And that gasoline comes from just five companies, four in Europe, one in India. The ships that deliver that gasoline to Iran are insured by just a handful of companies in Britain, France, Germany, and Japan. So there are pressure points, and if we can pressure those refining and insurance companies to stop doing business with Iran, we get Iran in an immediate economic stranglehold. Now, congressional legislation was recently introduced by Senator Lieberman and Kyle to that effect, to sanction any company that helps Iran import gas. Congress recently voted to ban any company from selling to the U.S. Strategic Oil Reserve if they also do business with Iran. British Petroleum, in anticipation of such a move, last year stopped selling gas to Iran. They figured it was better to miss out on business with Iran than risk losing their American business. So if these European, Indian, and Japanese companies do what BP did and stop selling gas to Iran, others will no doubt move in to fill the void. They will sell to Iran, but they will charge Iran a lot more for that gas, and that means the average Iranian will see much higher prices at the pump. And that's bound to make the Iranian citizens really mad.
They tried to raise prices there before, didn't they?
You know, just 2 years ago, Michael, when the mullahs tried to raise gas prices, the Iranian people rioted, and they torched gas stations and took to the streets. So the one thing we can do and should do immediately is cut off Iran's gasoline. It'll encourage those Iranian citizens who recently took to the streets to protest a sham election, those leading Iranians who dared protest against the regime and are now being tried in a kangaroo court, to take to the streets again and protest an incompetent government. And then they change the regime themselves. You know, that's the fundamental principle my boss, Ronald Reagan, realized, that we shouldn't try to change a country's leaders ourselves, but we can maneuver events so that they change their own leaders and the direction that their country goes, which is in their own best interest. And then they do it themselves, not us. That's how we help bring down the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, and that's how we help bring down the mullahs.
KT, thanks for the update. Thanks for being on the Savage Nation.
Thanks, Michael, for letting me have a chance to be on your wonderful show.
This is the Savage Nation.
Savage.